You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The Inuit are a well-known part of Canadian identity, yet their lives in the remote Arctic regions are very different from the majority of Canadians. This combination of the familiar and the exotic has given rise to a number of persistent myths about their language and culture. These stories, reproduced in classrooms and textbooks, contribute to misunderstandings that diminish the stature of traditional Inuit culture. John Steckley is the author of a recent book called White Lies About the Inuit. In this textbook, designed for introductory students, Steckley unpacks three of the myths about the Inuit. At the same time, he illustrates how knowledge is shaped by Western social science. John Steckley joins me this morning from Ontario to talk about his book. Hello, John.
Hello.
The first of the myths you tackle in your book is the one about the Inuit having 52 words for snow. Now, this is so common and well-known that it's actually a shock to find out that it isn't true. How did that come about?
Well, it developed like that. A lot of it has to do with sort of the development of sociology and anthropology. One of the important concepts is the idea of cultural relativity. You know, like you have to look at different cultures and they do things differently and you have to understand them in their own context. One of the big thinkers was American anthropologist Franz Boas. So he kind of drew attention. In the midst of saying, you know, different languages deal with the matters that the cultures think are important, he included, you know, English terms for different forms of water. And then he just kind of almost as a throwaway line, he said, oh, yeah, and Inuit terms for snow. And he mentioned a couple, probably, I think it was four. And then because, you know, he was who he was, and other people looking at it sort of picked up on that. And from scholar to scholar, it grew, you know, kind of like the old game of broken telephone or just even like any kind of story, you know, you add more as the story grows. So it quickly became seven among for a person by the name of Worf, who was very much involved with a hypothesis that languages are very much attuned to their culture. And then it grew to 20, and then now, you know, you can look at the internet or you can look at any source and they'll have all these terms for snow. And it seems like, you know, the person with the highest total wins.
So they don't actually have separate words for snow. They presumably do have ways to describe different kinds of snow.
It's a kind of matter of the difference of how Inuktitut, which is the Inuit language, is structured, right? Like most Aboriginal languages, word building is a very big thing. You know, you have these words that to English-speaking minds seem very, very long. You know, they construct a whole bunch of different elements on top of that. So when you see a whole bunch of words related to snow, what you're really seeing is a bunch of sentence-long words where there's one little root at the beginning and then a lot of things added. Like if I was talking about that hideous snow that's on the ground that's blocking my car, that kind of thing could be more likely said in one word, in Inuktitut. Whereas in English, you know, you've got this big descriptor there done by separating words. So it's just a matter of just sort of how do you construct a word and how do you construct a sentence.
John, why is it a problem that we think the Inuit have so many words for snow?
Well, in a couple of ways. I mean, one, basically, it's wrong. You know, but it's also my sense is that it's kind of insulting in two ways. One is typically when Aboriginal languages are described or were described, they were spoken about as only being able to deal with the concrete, that there were no abstract terms. That's because a lot of the people first describing the languages would say, well, you know, they have no term for church and no term for religion. Well, of course, having no churches, you're not going to have a term waiting around for it. And so they were described, very, very good concrete. It's kind of like the statement about the Inuit, that they're good with their hands, like with the implied, not so much with the brains. So it reinforces that idea that they're concrete. And there are a number of incredibly complex and actually beautiful philosophical abstract terms in Inuktitut that are blocked out, because it's kind of like, you know, when there's a story created in the news and, you know, a series of things happen, and you say, okay, this small thing here is the story and everything else is cut out. So it becomes the story for anthropologists and sociologists about Inuktitut is the snow. So they're not going to look any farther. Textbook writers are just going to repeat that. Teachers in intro classes are just going to repeat that. But there are other stories, but, you know, you just focus the story that has been told. So it's a, you know, insult to the thinking of the people, and it also doesn't allow people to pursue further into something, into other areas and under other concepts. It's not on people's radar, but that's sort of the one thing that people know. And it's too bad, as I said, because there's many other concepts and ways of thinking that you start. For example, like most Aboriginal languages, Inuktitut did not distinguish between masculine and feminine. There's no, you know, he or she. The third person singular is both.
Hmm.
And that's an interesting. You know, I teach a linguistics course, and when I do that, I talk about imagine. You know, how in English, you know, we're always, if I'm referring to, like, I have a sister who lives in North Van. If I spoke about her, as I'm doing now, and I would use she and her a lot, I'm just keep reinforcing with every sentence that she's female. Not, you know, and that becomes the story, she, her, she, that kind of thing. Whereas in Inuktitut, if the gender is important, then gender is talked about. If gender is not a major factor, then it's not.
Very interesting.
And that's true of most Aboriginal languages.
One of the other myths that you discuss in your book is well known as the 52 words for snow. It's the idea that Inuit elders disappear into a snowy night or float off on an ice floe, commit suicide, in other words, that's perceived to be for the good of the family group. Where did mm-hmm. that one come from?
Well, that came from, as far as I can figure, that came from, there was an American sea captain by the name of Hall, I think it was Hall. He, when he was visiting with the Inuit of a particular region, he noticed a couple of times that for elders who were dying, that they would leave them alone in the igloo, you know, kind of dying with dignity alone. And that got it started. And then sometimes people would see that if there was shortage of food and they were traveling and trying to travel quickly, they might leave the elders behind with the sense that they would come back to them because they were slowing people down. But they weren't abandoning them. They were just, leaving them there so that they didn't have to strain and they can go faster and that kind of thing. It became, I think Hollywood is as much to blame as anything here, because the movie Nanook of the North, which was incredibly popular when it came out about 80 years ago. Also, interestingly, the same time it was a hot summer and Nielsen's invented Eskimo pie, it focused in on that idea. And a number of significant movies did that. They focused in on abandoning the elder, and that became a part of the story. The other side of it is a sociologist called Emile Durkheim, one of his most famous work is called Suicide. And it referred to several kinds of suicide. Like it said, you know, suicide is a social phenomenon. Some groups are more likely than others to commit suicide. And one of the forms of suicide he talked about was altruistic, where people commit suicide for the group. And it was hard to come up with examples for that. So this sort of story that was floating around of elders being abandoned when times were tough fit into that really, really well. So it became the good exotic example. And of course you couldn't as, you know, unless you as a teacher were going to look into the literature, you couldn't contradict it. And you couldn't sort of go to your Inuit neighbor next door and say, hey, do you guys abandon your elders or what? You know, you can't do that. There's no check on that knowledge. So that way it grew as a, you know, a good example in class. I mean, one of my Rick Mercer, I love the example I use in the book of Rick Mercer and his, you know, when he used to do talking to Americans, and he had this petition where trying to get Canadians to stop the Canadian practice of abandoning our elders on the ice floes, right? So, I mean, I realized, wow. I mean, when I saw that, I heard that and saw it, I thought, wow, this is such a powerful myth. People really believe it. It's in gerontology books. When the study of gerontology came out, you know, cross-cultural studies of treatment of elders was important. And one of the reasons I say for this is that the people who write this, the sociologists and the anthropologists, come from cultures where there is no status elder, right? You know, in mainstream Canadian society. We don't speak of elders. It's only in more traditionally based cultures where the elder, you know, is the font of knowledge and is someone who is helped us, is respected. But we don't have that in mainstream North America. So even people trained as sociologists and anthropologists would be blind to it.
Does this misperception, this pervasive misperception about the relationship between the Inuit and the older people in their generations, does it have damaging effects on their culture currently?
Yes, it does, because Inuit young people today have the highest suicide rate in Canada. One even higher, I mean, generally speaking, and we talk about in Aboriginal culture, suicide is a problem, but particularly in Inuit culture. And there's a lot of, obviously, you know, people study that, and I've seen a couple of studies where they'd say, well, you know, suicide is a tradition among the people. And I read that, I just said, it's a tradition. Oh, yeah, well, we're just doing our traditional thing here. We're just killing ourselves, right? And it wasn't traditional. And unfortunately, when studies like that show it in the literature like that, it may get back to the people. It may get back to the kids. And they may think, oh, it is traditional, when it's not.
You wrote this textbook to try to address Canadian ignorance about Aboriginal people. Why are textbooks so prone to propagating myths like these?
Well, I think largely it's what I would call the textbook process. You know, a textbook gets written. People teach certain things. People teach from the textbook. There's very little impetus to change textbooks. I've written several textbooks, and the whole thing of changing, you know, because, you know, when you put forward your textbook, they have readers, people who teach it, say, you know, whether, you know, what, how they would change it, and they tend to say to what they've had before rather than, say, working on something new. So it's an inherently conservative process.
Is there kind of a momentum there, or sort of an inertia of correcting ideas which are propagated in textbooks?
Oh yeah, and it's not just sociology and anthropology; it's across the board. It's in biology. It's in, you know, it's in many, many areas. You know, people just repeat the story, and you know, to change that, you know, that, I mean, that really sort of shakes people up. And usually, too, I mean, people who write textbooks are not in it to create change. You know, it's not sort of, oh, I'm going to write textbooks and change that. Usually, you know, if you're involved with changing perception, you know, you're writing more directly the products of your research. It'd be interesting to study people who write textbooks. I mean, I didn't start writing until I was, you know, fairly well along in my career, and a lot of people of my age might be more conservative when they write. I'm not, but that's just me. You know, I get worse as I go on. I get more challenging as I get older. But that's me.
Are there ways then? Are there strategies that that teachers, professors can use to disrupt these myths, even though they may be present in textbooks? Is that something that could be successful?
Well, What they have to do is ask the question themselves that they try to get their students to ask. I mean, usually people in the social sciences, one of the major questions you get, you know, you're addressing sort of the critical thought of your students, And you tell them, okay, how you know something is as important as what you know. You know, how do you know this? It's not enough that something is right or wrong. It's how did you get this knowledge? And they have to turn it in on themselves. How do I know this? This thing that I put in my lesson, how do I really know this? And I think sometimes we just have to go through those things. I mean, I can say in my career as an anthropology teacher, whenever I've done this, I mean, sometimes it's quite shocking. I mean, examples that I have used, I don't use anymore because I ask myself, how do I know this? And then I checked it up. But that's the big question, just one question. How do I know this? And if you know, and then you seek it out. You seek out how you know it. Because sometimes you'll repeat stuff that you heard in first year and was poorly taught then, and you don't know where it comes from because, you know, you just put it into the lecture and it takes on a life. But that question's the key one. How do you know this?
Well, it's been really good talking with you this morning. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with John Steckley. He's the author of the introductory textbook, White Lies About the Inuit. It's published by Broadview Press. And John Steckley teaches anthropology at Humber College in Toronto.